What does it mean to be human? And do Christians experience the same losses, wrestle with the same fears, and struggle with the same inadequacies as those who don't know Jesus? In this sermon series, we are looking at the human experience to discover what it means to be fully human and fully devoted to Christ.
Well, good morning, Westside. It is good to see you as well. I, along with Matt, want to welcome you here on this Summer Sunday. Great to have you. As Matt said, we have a bunch of people gone on missions. We also have people that head out of town on holidays, but we know we have people that come in and join us during these summer weekends. And so if you are a guest, a first timer, or maybe it's been a long time, thank you for joining us today. And regular Westsiders, always great to have you. Always great to have you as well. We continue on today with our summer series that we're calling The Human Experience. And if you've been around over the last month or so, we've considered some of the shared experiences that we all have, experiences like apathy and sorrow and joy and shame. Last week, Matt addressed the experience of awe, wonder. Today, we're going to focus on loneliness. Next week, we're going to focus on lust. And so if you're around next week, you'll want to come back for that. But this is where we are today, looking at loneliness. So with that in mind, let's pray, and then we'll walk through this really important subject and see what God has for us as we encounter times of loneliness. So let's pray together. Father, guide us now, I pray. Guide us now, I pray, through your word by way of the Spirit. Open and show us things. Open things that need to be opened in our lives. Show us things that need to be shown to us. And I pray that as we respond, coming out of this time, that we would respond in a way that honors you, glorifies you, and strengthens and encourages us. I pray specifically as it relates to this topic for those that are living in this season. I pray that they would meet you in this time. I pray that perhaps the sense of hopelessness that really is guiding them, that would be overcome by way of the hope that is found in you. So I pray for the miraculous to take place. My words will not accomplish that. It will be a mere sermon, but this can be a time of ministry if you, by your grace, and again, through your word and spirit, invade this time. So I pray for that, for the sake of your name, for the sake of your name and our joy. And I pray for these things in the great name of Jesus. Amen. There is little doubt that the most venerated woman in the world today, globally speaking, is Mary, the earthly mother of Jesus. Mary is referred to by hundreds of millions as the Theotokos, the very mother of God. In Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox faith streams, she's considered an icon. She is referred to as the Lady of Perpetual Help, a special category of saint with a capital S. She is prayed to and referred to as the Blessed One. According to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it states there that the Church's devotion to the Blessed Virgin is intrinsic to Christian worship. There are an estimated 1.2 billion Roman Catholics in the world today and another 250 million plus Eastern Orthodox adherents who hold Mary in the highest regard. But even those who are more Protestant in their faith streams of Christianity and thus don't place the same importance on her still hold her up as a very important player in the redemptive story of God. That's Mary. But who's second? In other words, if Mary is first, who is number two? Oprah? Right? She may think she is. Is it Oprah? How about Michelle Obama or Katy Perry? Katy Perry has over 100 million Twitter followers, so maybe it's Katy Perry. Maybe it's someone who has since passed but is still greatly revered, like Joan of Arc or Mother Teresa, both Roman Catholic saints as well. What about Margaret Thatcher or Golda Meir or Indira Gandhi? All famous and accomplished in their own right, but there is one that trumps them all. One that actually goes by one name, and it's not Beyonce, all right? It's not Rihanna, it's not Madonna. one that, having died over thousands of years ago, is still remembered and honored by hundreds of millions of people today. Her name? Hagar. Hagar is an esteemed woman of Islam and considered by hundreds of millions of Muslims today as the mother of monotheism. Who is Hagar? Well, Hagar is an Egyptian maidservant, the second wife of Abraham and the mother of Ishmael. Ishmael is considered a prophet in Islam and also considered to be an ancestor of Muhammad. Hagar is not mentioned in the Quran, although she is referred to by way of the story of Abraham. But she is frequently mentioned, written of, comes up in other Muslim writings like the Hadith, which records the writings of Muhammad. Part of a devout Muslim's pilgrimage to Mecca today includes a portion that commemorates Hagar's journey in search of water in the wilderness, a practice that is meant to symbolize the celebration of motherhood in Islam. As part of the pilgrimage, a Muslim, drink from something that is called the Zamzam well. And they take some of the water back from that same pilgrimage in memory of Hagar. According to Muslim tradition today, both Hagar and Ishmael are buried in Mecca today, according to their tradition. Now, as many of you know, Hagar is written of. She's mentioned several times in the Bible. For example, in Galatians 4, Paul refers to Hagar allegorically to depict law and slavery. And what Paul does is he contrasts her to Sarah, who is used to depict faith and promise. Sarah is the free woman. Hagar is the slave woman. Sarah is the one who represents grace and the spirit, where Hagar represents works and the flesh. It's great teaching. But it's also teaching that is rather disparaging on Hagar, which, truth be told, is how many Christians view Hagar today in those types of ways. But is that altogether fair? I understand the role she played. I understand the picture she's meant to paint for us as it relates to the law and grace. I get that. I get what Paul does in Galatians 4. But what do we do then with God's gracious interaction with her in Genesis 16, which is where I would like you to turn with me this morning? And as you find that text, what do we do with the fact that of all the women in the Bible, every single one of them, some very prominent ones like Eve, Sarah, Deborah, and the aforementioned Mary, that Hagar is the only one that God addresses by name? And furthermore, what do we do with the fact that Hagar, is the only person in the Bible, male or female, to give God a name? No one else does that. Not Abraham, not Moses, not David, none of them. Some of them name places after God. For example, in Genesis 22, Jehovah Jireh, the name Jehovah Jireh, the Lord will provide. That is a name given to the place where God does it. But even in that event, Abraham at that time doesn't name God Jehovah Jireh. The only one that names God something, as I said, is Hagar. She's the only one. So what do we do with that? But back to my first question, which is specific to our time today, what are we to discover about a God who not only sees and enters Hagar's life at her loneliest and most forgotten, but quenches her thirst as well? Westside, what can we learn from Genesis 16 that can help us when we encounter our times of loneliness too? Well, let's take a look at it. Chapter 16, like I said, first book of the Bible, first three verses, let's read them. Now, Sarai, she's not yet Sarah, that's coming, so I'll refer to her as Sarai, Abram's wife. He'll become Abraham. But Abram's wife had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was, there she is, Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "Behold now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. So, after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. Just stop there. If you're taking notes, here's point number one, and it's for the husbands. Okay, write this down, husbands. Husbands, never, ever listen to your wife. There's a second part. I got to go back to my notes. Let me just add this. Oh, yeah, I forgot. There's a second part to that. Husbands, never, ever listen to your wives if, there it is, if they tell you to sleep with another woman so you can have kids, all right? So that wasn't meant to be disparaging on the women here. It's meant to take into account how foolish men can be at times. It's never good for harmony within a marriage, just so you know. But verse 2 ends by telling us that Abram didn't take my advice, but instead he listened to the voice of Sarai. And we could add as a footnote, and the world's been living with the consequences ever since. You see, the turmoil that enters this relationship here is the turmoil that the world, the Middle East in particular, continues to deal with today. You can read the history on that. To appreciate what's going on in these three verses, there are a few items that we need to be aware of. Here's the first. Let me give them to you rather quickly. They're important for us to appreciate the context, the culture at the time, what's going on emotionally. Here's the first. First, we need to be aware of the promise of God as laid out to Abram back in Genesis 15. Just double back. It won't be on the screen, but let me read verses 3-5 for you. And Abram said, verse 3, chapter 15, Genesis, same book. And Abram said, "Behold, you have given me no offspring." God is the one being addressed here. "And a member of my household will be my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. This man shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir." And he brought him outside and said, "Look toward heaven and number the stars if you're able to number them." Then he said to him, "So shall your offspring be." Let's read verse 6. "And he believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness." So we see the back and forth and what's taking place there, which helps us understand what's going on or what will go on in Genesis 16. Abraham says, "Hey God, I have no heir. And if this continues on, one of my own staff is going to take over for me. If something doesn't happen, I'm going to have to pass on my inheritance to him." God's response, "No worries. All is good. I promise that one day your quiver will be full." But the issue is, as we get into Genesis 16, is that Sarah wasn't getting pregnant, which is a big issue. Which leads to the second item that we need to be aware of, and that is, in that culture, and it continues today in certain cultures as well, in that culture, however, specifically, a woman's worth and identity rested almost entirely on her ability to have children. We need to be aware of this. It legitimized her. It certified her. It was the sign that God was for her. And Sarai was barren. But Sarah and Abram, they kept at it for 10 years. That's what we read. 10 years they kept at it. God had promised, after all, look at the sky, number the stars, that's going to be us. And yet, what followed was 120 episodes of anticipating and ovulating on a monthly basis. A day or two of doubt and depression followed thereafter, I am sure we can assume. 120 episodes, 10 years of this. In that culture, in the wake of the promise of Genesis 15, to a very small degree, I get this. To a very small degree. When my wife and I wanted to start having kids, we had it all mapped out. The plan was set. It was going to be very easy peasy. Here is the year we're going to get pregnant. The only problem was we couldn't get pregnant. Couldn't get pregnant for a couple of years. And I remember doing the tests and doing the reading and taking the temperatures and all of that. We made love all the time. All the time. I mean, I remember one time, do we have to make love again? And just being surprised that the words came out of my mouth. Never more horrific and evil words ever been uttered by anyone. But I got the frustration in that and the wonder, and perhaps this isn't going to happen, and having all sorts of doubts and angst and concerns and all of those types of things. So to a very, very, very small degree, I get that. I get this. I can think back to those times. But we've since have kids, and so that's why I say it's a very small degree, because I know that for some of you, it's a very big deal, and it's a current situation. And so when you read of Abram and Sarai wanting to have children in the midst of that culture and not being able to and having that desire, whether you're married now and you can't get pregnant, or perhaps you one day want to be a parent and you just can't find someone that wants to marry you and vice versa, it's very difficult. And so I don't want to make my situation your situation. I understand that it's much larger, but I bring it up to help you understand that this is very relevant to us. The loneliness, the angst, the depression perhaps that Abram and Sarai were going through, perhaps you can understand, and maybe that resonates with you too. So in that culture, a woman's worth and identity rested almost entirely on her ability to have children. A third item to be aware of: the culture at the time allotted an adoption practice of sorts. Here's how it worked. A barren woman with servants, so a barren woman that came from some money, had some cash, had some wealth, could give a servant of her choice to her husband as a lower level wife. And then the child born to that surrogate mother could be adopted by the head wife thereafter. This was entirely acceptable. It was a cultural practice. In fact, later, Leah and Rachel would adopt sons the same way. And so after 10 years of discouragement, Abram and Sarai decide to take advantage of this socially acceptable practice. It's understandable, right? I mean, put yourself in their place. You've received a promise of God. But to be fair, when you go back to Genesis 15, only Abram's mentioned. Sarai's name doesn't even come up. So maybe it would be okay for him to have a baby with someone else. After all, it was culturally acceptable at the time. Couple that with 10 years of no success, the indignation that Sarai was probably receiving, feeling, coming from others, and we can begin to understand, can't we, that they concluded, let's take matters into our own hands. This is what pain and longing and loneliness can lead to. It can tempt us towards some really unhealthy decisions, especially when everything and everyone else says, go ahead with it. The pain and the longing and the loneliness for Abram and Sarai came with being childless. But they can come for countless other reasons too, but the temptation is just the same. So when we drop into Genesis 16, we can understand what they did. And we can also appreciate why they did it, but what we can't do, Westside, what we can't do is affirm the decision. I say that for the mandate for marriage is very clearly laid out in Genesis 2, where we read, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast, cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. singular, not plural. Jesus affirms this design and layout thousands of years later in Matthew 19, verse 6. In fact, just hang a right, go to Genesis 17, and this is affirmed where we read in verses 15 and 16, and God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be your name. I will bless her, and moreover, I will give you a son by her. I will bless her, and she shall become nations. Kings of peoples shall come from her. As an aside attached to this, just because the Bible records an event or practice doesn't mean necessarily it's affirming it. In the same way, newspapers don't necessarily affirm what they report, they just report it. There are many things, especially in the Old Testament, that the Bible records, but in its recording, it's not affirming the practice. It's just recording it. It's letting you know, letting me know that the hero of the story, of God's story in the Bible, isn't the players in it, but Jesus himself. That's why they need him. Because we have a great tendency when we look around us and we measure things by only things here on the horizontal to make some really unwise decisions, which is the decision that was made by these two. But as I said earlier, this is still a temptation in our culture today around the world, certain cultures around the world. A couple of years ago, when I went to Tanzania to teach at the Bible school there, I was teaching through the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 to 7. And in Matthew 5 to 7, there is a teaching on divorce and marriage. And I'm unpacking this in a culture that I didn't realize at the time allowed for husbands, men, to have multiple wives. Didn't realize that. So I'm teaching through this subject. I'm talking about marriage and being faithful and spouses, man, and just hanging tough and let's love one another. And then there was a hand raised in the back. And the question, I kid you not, the question was, well, what happens if she's barren? Huh? What? What do you mean? Well, you can't expect me to stay married just to her if she's barren. I've got to get another wife. And I said, well, You can't divorce her just because she's... No, not divorce her, just get another one. I'll get back to you. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. This is crazy. But in all seriousness, what I pressed in on is you are taking your cues by this kingdom, and you're part of a different kingdom, a kingdom that supersedes this kingdom. And so in this kingdom, this is the design and layout. Not this kingdom governing you. I have a friend talked to way back in the day, not really close, but a guy that was a church planter in Utah. Every Sunday afternoon, they would drive down to southern Utah, and they would go into a fundamentalist Mormon area, and they would do ministry there. And every Sunday, they would go in and they would do stuff for the kids. It was great. Lo and behold, one day, one of the guys that he was ministering to came to Jesus. He accepted Jesus as a Savior. The only issue was he had 19 wives. And so I'm talking to this friend of mine, and he says, what would be your counsel? I don't know, two TVs. I don't know, you know. It's a lot of square footage. I don't know what to tell you. No, I didn't know what to say. At that time, I said, I'll get back to you. I got to go. I've got no time. But in all seriousness, what's taking place here isn't exclusive of what's taking place here. And so how do we encounter? How do we deal with this? What do we do? How do we speak into it? It's really important for us to know how tempting it can be in these times to make wrong decisions and take our cues from what is around us. Let's pick things up in verses 4 and 5. And he went in to Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt, just note that word, on her mistress. And Sarai said to Abram, may the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked on me with contempt. There's our word again. May the Lord judge between you and me. Okay, what's going on? Sarai's ticked. Sarai is saying to Abe, Abe, I am so mad at you for listening to me. Things are only worse now. Right? That's what she's saying. Things are only worse now. Let's let God decide who's worse between me and you. And my vote is you. That's what she's saying. So angry. Why is she so angry? Well, for a couple of reasons that I think, one, maybe not as obvious. Second one, certainly is. But a couple of reasons. One, for not only had the pregnancy of Hagar assured all that the barrenness issue, physically speaking, was with Sarai, with the presence of Hagar and now the child she was carrying, a constant reminder of it. So that's one reason. It didn't lay with Abram. The physical issue is on her. But two, Hagar, we read, now looked on Sarai with contempt. That word contempt is really important. It's a word that speaks of scorn, ridicule, and abasement, as being viewed as worthless and beneath consideration. The way the culture viewed the barren Sarai was now how Hagar viewed her too, but it was only now amped up for Hagar. Why? She's pregnant. She's legitimized. And she is carrying the son of promise too. The covenant promise of God in all eyes, all understanding what's taking place, the covenant family was going to come through Hagar and not Sarai. So that's why she was angry. I borrow this thought, and I'll have to paraphrase it. The thought is this. Although Sarai and Hagar couldn't have been more different, one a Hebrew, the other Egyptian, one rich, the other poor, one free, the other a slave, one an insider of the covenant, the other an outsider of it, they both did share something in common. What was that? They both found their worth in their womb. Hagar felt superior. She flaunted her fortune. And she looked down on Sarai, who in contrast was despondent and apoplectic. That's what's going on here. But thank goodness that at this point, the great leadership of Abram surfaces. Just notice what takes place in verse 6. But Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your servant is in your power. Do to her as you please." Attaboy. Attaboy, Abe. What a step up, man. Hey, Abe, here, just understand the interchange between these two. Abe, I can't get pregnant. Why don't you make the nanny your second wife and have a baby with her? Abe's response, okay. Okay, sounds great. What takes place? She gets pregnant. Hey, Abe, you dolt. Your nanny wife is pregnant and she disdains me and I can't stand her and this is on you. Okay. Do whatever you want with my now pregnant wife slash nanny. Let me repeat that. Do whatever you want with my now pregnant wife. So what does Sarai do? Second part of verse 6. Then Sarai dealt harshly with her. There is so much packed into that word harshly. Then Sarai dealt harshly with her, and she fled from her. And you can see if you look down in verse 7, the last word there, that in verse 7, she flees to a place called Shur. Abram's camp is in a place called Hebron, which is 100 miles away from Shur. Shur is located in the badlands of Egypt. One commentator writes this about Shur. Few places on the planet are as forbidding for humans as Shur. An unending roll of yellow sand and gravel. No wonder Shur means the wall. No one passes. Surely not a pregnant woman alone, forsaken by her husband, with no one to look after her, no one seeing her, no one to hear her cry. I mean, Westside, how harsh must the treatment on Hagar have been for her to choose this? I mean, how harsh did Sarai treat her? And how painful must have been the disregard that she and the baby inside of her received from her now husband, Abram. It's kind of tough to like Abram and Sarai at this point, isn't it? Hagar would have been frightened. She would have been angry. She would have been confused. She perhaps would have been regretful too, but in addition to all of that, she would have certainly felt alone, literally, by herself in a desert place and nowhere to turn and no one looking out for her. Can you imagine her loneliness and heartache? Without resources, she's forsaken, no one to turn, and a baby inside. Have you ever felt this at least to some degree? I mean, I know this is an extreme situation, but forsaken and alone, disregarded, sent away, let down, no one seen, hopeless, wondering, does anybody care? Is there a future? How am I going to get through this? Well, even if you get that to some degree, you're beginning to appreciate what's going on in Hagar's life now. Now, before turning back to the text, let me first offer some overarching comments regarding loneliness and some of the reasons for why it comes. Let me give you four. Three of them are reasons for why loneliness comes, and then one takeaway later. After the third, we'll double back on our text, then we'll leave you with a takeaway. But let me begin for looking at the three reasons why it comes. Here's the first. Sometimes our loneliness comes by way of our sin, guilt, and shame. And we hide. This is where we have an overlap with what we looked at a couple of weeks ago when we looked at the shame of Adam and Eve, who did a similar thing. When they, in their sin, they hid and they covered up. We follow suit. Sometimes we hide because of our sin, and sometimes we hide in our sin. Westside, sometimes we are lonely because we do it to ourselves. We hide because we are governed by our shame or because we are fearful of being found out. So we hide. And we're lonely because we do so. And thus, and please understand this, loneliness isn't simply a lack of people in my life problem. There are a lot of lonely married people and those with families. And those who have a lot of friends, and those who go out on a lot of dates, and so on. You can have a lot of people in your life and still be lonely, can't you? And therefore, don't confuse being alone with loneliness. Loneliness is a heart issue. It's a spiritual issue. With the remedy for it not simply adding more people. Oftentimes, our loneliness issue is the presence of something in our lives that keeps us from deep relationship with God and others. That's a statement from a pastor that I'll refer to later in this same point. But I know at this point, there's pushback. There's common pushback at this point that comes from people who say, but Norm, we're created in the image of God, who is triune in nature. And therefore, God exists in fellowship. He exists in relationship. We are therefore created after him, and therefore, my issue with loneliness comes because there's nobody in my life. I mean, it does say that it wasn't good for Adam to be alone, and therefore, I feel lonely because I don't have enough people around. But here's my question. Was Adam lonely? I agree that Adam was alone. And that wasn't good. But was loneliness the issue? Well, I would suggest that it wasn't, for he was sinless. And therefore, he had perfect fellowship with God. And thus, loneliness wasn't the concern of God, but something more. Paul Matthies, the one I referred to just a moment ago, he affirms this when stating, God approached Adam in the Garden of Eden and said, it is not good that the man should be alone, not because Adam was lonely, but because he was making a statement about himself. He was saying, it is not good for man to be alone because one man cannot glorify me by himself. God creates an entire race of people to glorify him. The array of gifts is essential if the church is to function as God intended. Image bearers are not lone rangers, and we see the great scriptural truth that, and let me end the quote by taking you on the screen and having you notice it. This is how the quote ends. God has not given us people to complete us, but to complement us, as we seek to glorify him together in community. West Side, Tom Cruise was wrong in Jerry Maguire. He was wrong. No person completes us, and nor were they ever meant to. We don't have that role for one another. I need to make this point, for too many of us are making bad decisions by seeking the arms of another as a way to remedy our loneliness. This is where loneliness tests us. Loneliness, like fasting, calls us to consider what we hunger for most. So that's one way loneliness comes. By way of our decisions, the erroneous or the air-filled decisions, the decisions that lead to bad choices and the aftermath of it. Here's another reason why they come. Sometimes our loneliness comes by way of our faithful obedience. I say this because there are several instances where Paul refers to the loneliness and abandonment that came as a result of his ministry. For example, if you've ever studied the book of 2 Timothy, he refers to this quite a bit. All who are in Asia turned away from me, he writes in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 15. He adds this in the fourth chapter, at my first defense, no one came to stand by me, but all deserted me. And specifically, he also writes in chapter 4, Demas, in love with the present world, deserted me. So there are times where we will experience loneliness or being alone because of our faithful obedience, where people scatter from us, they're ashamed of us. And there's a third reason. And sometimes our loneliness comes by way of our circumstances or others who place us in seasons of loneliness. In other words, sometimes we are thrust into it. We're abandoned by a spouse. We're relocated. We lose someone we love, for example. Which brings us back to Hagar in our text. Hagar was thrust into loneliness by Abram and Sarai, but it was in this place that God meets her. And notice what he does. Take a look at verses 7 to 12. The first thing that he does is he calls her and he engages her, verses 7 and 8. The angel of the Lord. Now, let me just stop there. Some of you right now are going, okay, this is an angel addressing her. Why do you say God addresses her? This will be clear as we get later on in the text. There are angels of the Lord, and then there is the angel of the Lord talked about, referred to in the Old Testament text, what people refer to as either a theophanies or a Christophanies. Verse 7, the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness. Let me stop there. There are people that suggest this has to be a miraculous spring, because sure didn't have springs of water. Take that for what it's worth. The angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, the spring on the way to Shur, and he said, Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going? She said, I am fleeing from my mistress Sarai. So we have the address and we have the engagement of the Lord. But then he also instructs her in verse 9. The angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit to her. But after instructing her to return, he also promises her in verses 10 to 12. The angel of the Lord also said to her, I will surely multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you are pregnant and shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, which means God hears. Because the Lord has listened to your affliction, he shall be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone, and everyone's hand against him, and he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen. So we see now the promise to her. This promise from God to Hagar here should remind us of God's covenant promise to Abram just a chapter ago. A covenant with Abram there is now a covenant with Hagar here. Now, there are a lot of things that time doesn't allow us to unpack from these verses, but just note them. Note what God does in this engagement, but I don't want to spend a lot of time here because I want to get to verse 13. I love verse 13. It's one of the sweetest verses in the entire Bible, but why I want to get there and why I love it so much is because it's the ultimate answer to our battles with loneliness. Let me read verse 13. It is so tender. So she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, "You are a God of seeing." For she said, and please note this, "Truly here I have seen him who looks after me." As I said, a sweet, tender verse. But what really stands out about it is that in spite of what was just promised to her, verse 10, becoming a great nation, Hagar focuses more on the fact that God sees her. You notice that? In fact, she is so wrapped up in that realization that she gives God a name, Elroy, the God who sees. But she says, God sees me at the end of the verse, and I've seen the one who looks after me. And Westside, this is what enabled her to walk back to Abram and Sarai. I can do it because God sees me. And he will look after me. And he does. But the same is true for us as well. Hagar learned something here that Abram and Sarai had yet to learn. And I wonder if it's something that we need to learn too. That God does see, and he does hear, and he does promise. And he calls her to go back to camp. Which leads to the one takeaway that I referred to a while back, the one takeaway that I want to leave you with, and that is, loneliness can't be solved by succumbing to it. Loneliness, isolation, is not a solution to our problems either. Huddling by ourselves is never a solution. We must fight against isolation. It is not good to be alone. That is a truth of us. Like Hagar, we must walk back to camp, but walk back in the realization that God sees and God hears and God goes with us too. It begins here. And as we see, this chapter ends with Hagar going back to Abram and Sarai and giving birth to Ishmael. But before that takes place, a third naming occurs. There's three namings in Genesis 16. There's the naming of Ishmael, the God who hears. There's the naming of God himself, Elroy, the God who sees. But the third naming comes up in verse 14. The well where Hagar meets God is named Beer Lahairoi, which means the well of the living one who sees. As one writes, the place of the wall becomes the place of the well. You know, as I begin wrapping up, because my time is done, As I begin wrapping up, have you ever considered how much good takes place in the Bible when women hang out at wells? You know what I mean? It's fantastic. It's a common theme in the Bible. If you're a woman and you hang out at a well, it's going to be great. Especially when it comes to encountering ones they love. I mean, think about it. Rebecca, she's proposed to at a well. Rachel meets Jacob at a well. Zipporah meets Moses at a well. Like the water cooler of their time, man. You know what I mean? It's fantastic. And Hagar, now Hagar, abandoned by her husband, meets God at a well too. Does this remind you of any other well encounters in the Bible? Of any other outcast women who long to be seen and be known, but had probably lost hope that they ever would be? How about the well encounter in John chapter 4, where hope prevailed when Jesus met a Samaritan woman and told her that he could give her water, but not just any water, living water from a God who sees? And after this encounter, she returned, just like Hagar, to the very people who didn't want anything to do with her, confessing, "Come and see. Come and see a man who knew everything about me. He sees me, and he noticed me in my loneliness, a loneliness that I so often try to satisfy in the arms of another. And he talked to me, and he offered me a drink." I close by quoting Laura Copley, who sums up the well encounters of Hagar and the Samaritan woman this way. She writes, "Perhaps both these outsider women came face to face with a true husband's eyes. A true husband who, like Hagar's son, would also be cast outside the father's house. And on the cross, with everyone's hand against him, would become alone and unseen by the Father. So that we would always, always be seen and wooed and embraced by God." Would you rise, Westside, please, as we go into a time of response?